It creates instability in the project, and this administration has continued to insert instability into the project.
A shakeup on the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation Board has lawmakers worried. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, volunteers try to save starving MERS, landing in Anchorage far off course.
Most of the time when you offered them food, they would just turn their head away or, you know, scurry away.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alaska Pacific University is accepting applications for all undergraduate programs for the spring 2016 semester. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
You don't normally associate State Gas Line Corporation and drama, but this weekend, the state-owned Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation was the source of all kinds of drama. The corporation, known as AGDC, is responsible for the state's share of the massive Alaska LNG project to bring natural gas from the North Slope. And in the space of 24 hours, starting on Friday, Governor Bill Walker removed two board members, including the chairman, and the president resigned. With these changes, Walker has consolidated control over an agency and a gas line project originally created by his predecessor, Sean Parnell. APRN's Rachel Waldholtz explains why that matters and what's next.
The sun wasn't even up on Saturday morning, and already the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation was making news. When board members gathered for their early morning meeting, there were two new nameplates at the table. And then, within minutes of calling the meeting to order, board member Hugh Short said he had an addition for the agenda, discussing the resignation of AGDC president Dan Fauske. Fauske had led the organization since its founding in 2010 as a unit within the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, which he oversaw for the better part of two decades. His resignation letter didn't give a reason for his departure, but it was clear to everyone in the room why he left. Here's Governor Bill Walker speaking at a press conference later Saturday afternoon.
I let them know that I think we need to have a person there with different qualifications. There's no question about that. Did I get a directive that they must do that? No, I don't give directives, but they certainly knew my belief.
Walker couldn't fire Fauske directly, but he made it clear he wanted new leadership, someone with more natural gas experience and someone who fully supports his approach.
What we need to do is need to bring some alignment to this project internally. You know, we have some agencies sort of sometimes at cross purposes, and we need to make sure that that's not the case.
Walker was a fierce critic of AGDC and the gas line project during his campaign last fall, arguing it wasn't transparent enough and handed too much power to the state's partners, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips. In January, just after taking office, he removed three board members. With the recent changes, he has now replaced six of seven board members in the past year. There are several other state agencies involved in the gas line project, the Departments of Natural Resources, Revenue, Law. Each of their heads are appointed by the governor. With Fauske's resignation, almost no one in the gas line leadership is from the previous administration.
Well, I think it creates instability in the project, and this administration has continued to insert instability into the project.
State Senator Anna McKinnon, a Republican from Eagle River, says it's the governor's prerogative to change board members, but this kind of reshuffling worries her. The governor also recently said he's looking for a different role for the state's lead negotiator, Rigdon Boykin.
I have no idea who's leading this project. Absolutely not.
Think how what your reaction would be if this went on with the Permanent Fund Corporation.
That's oil and gas consultant Brad Keithley. He points out that all of this comes as the state is in the middle of negotiating key agreements with its oil company partners.
Firing the president and going out and having a search for a new president at a time when we should be keeping on track to get those contracts done. I think the governor has the right to appoint the people he has trust in, but it's the timing and the process that's troublesome to me.
The board meeting on Saturday was originally called for two very different reasons. Board members were scheduled to take a final vote to buy out TransCanada. That passed unanimously. But a second vote was postponed. That was to authorize work on the Alaska LNG project for another year. All four partners must vote yes by December 4th for the project to move forward. Until the recent shakeup, the state's vote was a foregone conclusion. But speaking with reporters on Saturday, Walker said the state isn't yet ready to cast that yes vote. First, he says he wants assurances from the state's partners that if any company pulls out, it won't withhold the gas it controls from the project.
By approving the work plan and budget today, there's no incentive for us to receive those assurances, whatnot.
We do have leverage, Walker said. Leverage is not a bad thing. The board is scheduled to vote on whether to continue the project December 3rd. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
Now that the FDA has approved a genetically engineered salmon for human consumption, Costco appears to be joining Safeway and other retailers in a commitment not to sell it. The Seattle Times reports Costco issued a statement on Friday saying it does not intend to sell the transgenic salmon at this time.
This is a major step forward from the weak statement which Costco previously made over the summer.
Dana Pearls works for Friends of the Earth, one of the groups that's led a massive consumer campaign urging Costco to reject the Aqua Advantage salmon. Pearls, though, says she's not sure of the extent of Costco's new commitment.
We are currently in dialogue to understand more about their statement.
Costco did not respond to a request for an interview today. It may be a while before Aqua Advantage is for sale anywhere in the U.S. The CEO of the company that makes it told the New York Times it will take about 2 years for the fast-growing salmon to reach market size. The only FDA-approved facility for growing them is in Panama, and it can only produce about 100 tons of salmon per year. The company hopes to eventually see its fish farmed in the U.S. Alaska's congressional delegation has fought to stop what they call frankenfish for years, and Senator Lisa Murkowski says the fight is not over.
I'm not sure if we can get the FDA to reverse this. I'm going to keep working on it, but at a bare minimum, people around this country need to know what they're serving their families when it comes to seafood.
Murkowski says she'll seek a labeling requirement for genetically engineered fish. She also announced today she'll block Senate confirmation of the nominee for FDA commissioner. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, teens in Juneau sleep in the cold to raise awareness about their homeless peers.
We're just trying to spread the word that it does occur and you might not be aware of it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
An increase in dead or starving common MERS has expanded beyond coastal communities and into urban areas in recent weeks. An Anchorage bird rehabilitation center that usually sees one or two MERS a year has gotten 20 this month. As KSKA's Monica Goki reports, all were starving.
At the Bird Treatment and Learning Center in Anchorage, a cluster of five black and white birds huddles together in the corner of a plastic tub. They almost look like little penguins. Each has a dab of paint on its beak.
That's nail polish, identifying nail polish. There's triple red dot, and that's double red dot, and there's single red dot. That's how we tell them apart.
Volunteer Dave Schreier offers one a herring with a pair of forceps. It grabs it eagerly with its beak, wiggles its head side to side, then the fish disappears down the gullet. It's exactly what he wants to see. When these birds first came in, they were so severely emaciated that they couldn't eat a whole fish.
Most of the time when you offered them food, they would just turn their head away, like the one back in the corner was doing, or, you know, scurry away.
Dead and starving common MERS are being cataloged across Alaska right now, and some wonder if it might be related to the high mortality rates being seen in other marine wildlife, like whales, sea otters, and fish. The seabirds are increasingly turning up places they don't belong. Bird Center Director Guy Runko flips through their chart.
This next one says that it was found in Palmer as well at the state fairgrounds.
Now, Anchorage and the Mat-Su are unusual places to find these seabirds. MER die-offs aren't unprecedented. They've coincided with El Nino years or severe weather events in the past, but this one is disconcerting due to its length and its geographic breadth. Kodiak-based fish and wildlife biologist Robin Corcoran says the first reports of dead MERS started coming in April, and they've escalated since then.
I know that I've documented just in my personal surveys over 300 dead common MERS on the beaches along the road system here in Kodiak.
Scientists are still trying to get a grip on the scale of the die-off, but beach comber programs in the lower 48 have documented dead MERS as far south as California.
It's the same story everywhere. We're seeing a big increase in the number of dead common MERS. And with the large scale of the event, I think what's most commonly believed at this point is that it's related to the warm sea surface temperatures and that blob of warm water that's developed.
Enter the blob. It's an unusually warm, well, blob of seawater that's pressed up against the west coast. Scientists have a hunch it might be influencing the distribution of the forage fish MERS depend on, hence all the starving birds. But it's hard to tell. Corcoran says they've sent more than 40 dead birds to the National Wildlife Health Center for autopsies in Madison, Wisconsin.
With only one exception, all of our birds have been emaciated, no body fat, and no stomach contents.
Because the birds don't have any stomach contents, scientists can't adequately test for paralytic shellfish poisoning, or PSP, which tends to be more prevalent when warm ocean temperatures give rise to algal blooms. PSP is a primary suspect in other marine die-offs happening right now. Corcoran has a hunch that the MERS's trouble is compounded by a quirk in their biology, the fall molt, when they're flightless for about 40 days. Growing back their feathers is energy intensive. By the time the birds can fly again, they're sapped of energy.
So they're trying to fly around, but I think they're exhausting their resources and ending up in some weird places.
Weird places like parking lots, the state fairgrounds in Palmer, or even downtown Anchorage. At the Anchorage Bird Treatment and Learning Center, volunteers like Schreyer signed up for round-the-clock feeding shifts to rehabilitate the MERS in their care. The birds were tube-fed, a smoothie of salmon and hooligan.
Somebody holds them, and the other person kind of opens their beak and puts the tube down. No, they don't enjoy it. And we don't like to do it if you don't have to, because it's stressful for the bird.
Stressful for the birds, but necessary to save their lives. All of the MERS are gaining weight at a steady clip.
These are happier birds.
And the Bird Center anticipates releasing them back into the wild in the coming weeks. In Anchorage, I'm Monica Goki.
The Sitka Tribe of Alaska wrote a letter to the Anchorage Division of the FBI alleging racial bias exists within the Sitka Police Department. The FBI is currently investigating a tasing incident of an Alaska Native teenager in the Sitka jail last year. The letter was penned shortly after the FBI announced it would take the lead on the case. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
The letter was written to the special agent in charge at the FBI, the agency investigating the tasing of Franklin Hoogendoorn last year. It asks for a couple of things. The first is to consider racial bias as a factor in the case. The letter reads, "This incident is symptomatic of other actions by the Sitka Police Department which have alarmed citizens of this tribe for many years. Many of our citizens believe such prejudice does exist within the local police department." At the bottom is the signature of Tribal Council Chairman Mike Baines.
I've heard about a lot of natives getting assaulted by the police and that kind of thing, and that is pretty common, happens pretty often. I mean, that's one of our main concerns, I guess, and this way it's been coming out nationwide that it's happening all over. It's just a real concern for us, and we want to do as much as we can to stop it from, you know, growing locally anyway.
At present, Sitka Tribe of Alaska has 4,000 enrolled tribal citizens. Hoogendoorn is a citizen of the native village of Koyak outside of Nome. Baines would not go into further detail about the incidents described in the letter, nor would the tribe's attorney. I asked him whether he felt the issue was department-wide or isolated to single officers.
I think there's some that are, you know, pretty respectful and I've had pretty respectful interactions with some of them, but just the way the police chief said that the incident didn't break any department policy. I think that's a pretty big concern that the policies allow for them to taser the young man's a pretty big issue.
Shortly after the arrest took place on September 6th, 2014, Sitka Police Chief Sheldon Schmidt reviewed the footage. He determined the actions of the three officers complied with arrest policies. Those policies have since changed. KCAW's public records request for the current policies was denied. In sending the letter, Baines also asks for inclusion. He cites a Clinton-era executive order, which requires federal agencies to consult tribal governments when considering policies that would impact tribal citizens. He writes, "The Sitka Tribe of Alaska is ready, willing, and able to do government-to-government consultation." The FBI confirms an investigation is pending. For this reason, Sitka City Administrator Mark Gorman and Police Lieutenant Jeff Ankerfeldt said the municipality and department had no comment at this time. Gorman previously reported that the police department informed the city of this event shortly after it happened. Chief Schmidt also said the video does not depict Hoogendoorn's alleged level of resistance prior to custody. The FBI could not comment on any correspondence from Sitka Tribe, but did say that, as with all investigations, the agency follows up on all leads. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
A group of Fairbanks City leaders are working to find money to demolish the Polaris building. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, they've grown frustrated awaiting action on the deteriorating downtown high-rise.
Anchorage real estate developer Mark Marlowe has been trying for over a decade to secure financing to renovate the long-abandoned 1950s Polaris Hotel into apartments, and City Council member David Pruse is through waiting.
We should just knock it down and be done with it.
Pruse, who leads a city Polaris work group, says condemnation enables demolition of the 11-story concrete structure, but it would cost millions.
A little bit beyond our budget at the city of Fairbanks, so our task is to go see if we can find federal funds.
Polaris owner Marlowe of Anchorage could not be reached for comment, but City Council member Jim Matherly, an ex-banker, says he's in regular communication with him.
His intention is to still revitalize it.
Matherly says Marlowe, who's been successful with similar projects in Anchorage, is awaiting response on a federal funding application. Matherly says something needs to happen given the building's condition.
It's ugly. It's a huge albatross around his neck and around the city's neck.
City Mayor John Eberhardt is optimistic that if the Polaris goes, it can be replaced with something new.
That site was identified as the best site in Fairbanks for a performing arts center.
Councilman Pruse says no timeline is set for Marlowe to take action on the Polaris.
His deadline is us getting the money to knock it down.
Pruse says that could take years. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
About 200 kids and teenagers in Juneau are homeless. There are students without adequate or regular housing in every school in the district. This past weekend, high school students slept out in the cold to raise awareness. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Between Saturday night and Sunday morning, temperatures dropped to the low to mid-30s. Two dozen high school students participating in the sleepout were prepared with
sleeping bags, big winter coats. Some people brought
lots
blankets,
of clothes,
layers.
17-year-old Riley Walsh is a senior at Juno Douglas High School. She and other students built makeshift shelters out of cardboard boxes and duct tape under the outdoor covered area at Riverbend Elementary School. She said the goal was to bring attention to their friends and fellow students who are homeless.
Because it's kind of something that you can't really tell always if someone is struggling with homelessness. So we're just trying to spread the word that it does occur and you might not be aware of it.
The cardboard structures are largely symbolic. Kids in Juneau who don't have permanent housing aren't typically sleeping outside. 16-year-old junior Gabby Keto said they're more likely to be hopping from couch to couch.
People, when they think of homeless, they think of them sleeping outside and in boxes rather than sleeping in a house and like just different houses each night.
Some homeless youth stay with families at shelters through St. Vincent de Paul or AWARE. Others turn to Juno Youth Services, which offers a 10-bed emergency shelter at Cornerstone Residential Facility. Executive Director Walter Majoris says the organization plans to reopen its transitional living program early next year. It'll house six individuals ages 16 to 21. Majoro says some kids and teens are homeless due to family discord and instability.
There may be family violence going on. There may be sexual abuse. There may be alcoholism or drug abuse in the family. There may be a single-parent family that creates some instability. Oftentimes, there's a parent that is incarcerated.
Juno Youth Services offers counseling for mental health, substance abuse, and family reunification. Another resource is the Zach Gordon Youth Center. Manager Jordan Nigro says staff members work hard to build relationships.
You know, if kids have meaningful connections with adults, they do better in every aspect of their life. And that impacts kids, whether they're homeless, whether they're not homeless, and also can help kids who are on the cusp.
At school, homeless students are offered help with transportation, free meals and snacks, clothing and shoes, toiletries, and assistance with activities fees. Dixie Weiss is the faculty advisor of the service club Interact at Juno Douglas High School. Interact has helped organize the annual sleepout since 2004. Besides raising awareness, the sleepout also raises money. Weiss has seen firsthand how the funds help.
Time and time again, these kids are giving you these big bear hugs because they never imagined they'd get that yearbook or that senior hoodie or the support.
Weiss says the sleepout also teaches the students participating an important lesson.
That sitting next to them in a class, day in and day out, there's this kid that is, against all odds, making it. That they have courageous peers, and this is a way to support that courage.
So far, the students have raised about $3,000 and are accepting donations through the end of November. Half the proceeds will go to the school district and the other half to the Zach Gordon Youth Center. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Anthony Choquette's brother-in-law says the family did everything they could to help him before he died by suicide last month at the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention in Anchorage. KTOO's Jennifer Canfield has more.
He was a happy, fun-loving guy. He was really an awesome person.
Roger Holmberg says he and his wife first learned about last month's suicide at the Dena'ina Center while watching TV. He says no one called him or the family to tell him it was Anthony Choquette. They learned later after news outlets published his name.
When we heard the news that someone had committed suicide at the AFN, immediately you think, well, that's tragic in a meeting like that. And not only that, the family, how, you know, this affects the family, not knowing that it was my brother-in-law. So when I heard later that evening, about 8:30, it was like a spear went through me and I was numb.
Holmberg was asked to speak on behalf of the family. He wouldn't say what kind of problems Choquette was facing, just that the family had done everything they could to help, but he walked away from it. They'd gotten him into housing, but he left it, and eventually ended up at the Brother Francis shelter in downtown Anchorage.
So we still continued to try to work with him, and the response was not good.
Friends who were near Choquette before he jumped said he wasn't acting normal that day. Holmberg said everything happened so fast that no one was able to stop him, though they tried.
He was facing some major things in his life, and you know, when people reach the bottom, they're desperate. And if we can't see that, there's signs, there's signals that people send that we're not probably sensitive enough to sometimes to catch it.
The family came together and grieved. Holmberg got to thinking there had to be something he could do.
It's the most traumatic, I believe, because it's so sudden and it's not normal. So therefore, you're left with, you know, what happened? Why did it happen? you know, what was going through the person's mind. We can't answer those questions.
As an evangelical pastor, singer, and songwriter, Holmberg travels frequently to places such as Guatemala and Haiti. He just returned from Honduras the morning of his brother-in-law's death. A few years ago, Holmberg says he had an idea to bring together members of the faith community to offer support to either those thinking about suicide or the family and friends who are ultimately left behind. He saw that while suicide prevention organizations were doing as much as they could, the spiritual aspect of suicide wasn't being addressed very much, and he wanted to change that. But the idea fell by the wayside as his travels claimed more and more of his time. After Choket's death, he finally decided to act, and about a week later, he met with a group of pastors and suicide prevention workers. He's still looking to connect with people interested in the effort.
It's comforting to know people care, but it can't be a one-time. The answer is not a one-time thing, because who knows who's next? So there must be I'm calling it a safety net for both. The one who does that and for the family, because it's so tragic. It's so beyond words.
Life is short, Holmberg said, and often our priorities are not what they should be. His priority today is to find a way to help families cope with the sudden loss of a loved one to suicide.
That was KTOO's Jennifer Canfield reporting. If you or someone you know is thinking about suicide, the Alaska Care Line can be reached at 877-266-HELP. There are now two Coast Guard cutters that carry the name Monroe. The Kodiak Daily Mirror reports a new cutter by that name was christened in Missouri on November 14th. This Monroe has been built over the last 2 years and will go into service in 2016. The first Monroe was commissioned in 1971. The Coast Guard says the 378-foot long cutter based in Kodiak is nearing the end of its life. The new Monroe is 418 feet long. Both ships are named after Signalman First Class Douglas Monroe, the only Coast Guard member to earn the Medal of Honor. Coast Guard says having two ships with the same name doesn't happen often, but it does ensure the name Monroe will continuously remain as part of the Coast Guard fleet. Finally tonight, a correction in a story on Friday on an Alaska Supreme Court opinion dismissing charges against three Southeast subsistence fishermen. We reported the fishermen were arrested. The men were given citations, but not arrested. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz and Monica Goki in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Emily Kwong in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Lisa Fu and Jennifer Canfield in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council promotes local fishermen and seafood caught by Alaskans for Alaskans. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. Alaska Pacific University is accepting applications for all undergraduate programs for the spring 2016 semester. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.